If you do a New York Times search on hypocrisy, you get quite a few hits. It comes up over the Reggie Bush issue of him giving back his Heisman Trophy Award. It comes up over politics on both sides of the aisle and how different public figures act and what they say. It comes up in religion, of course. So what do you say? Have you ever had someone tell you, you know, the church is full of hypocrites? Has anybody ever had someone tell them that? So what do you say? What are you supposed to say to that? What I suggest, our text, I think, suggests us to say is, you know, you're right. But you're not the first person to say that. It actually, the Bible itself calls people outside the church hypocrites, religious people, but it even calls Christians, even Christian leaders inside the church, hypocrites. So let's see how that shows up in our text this morning. I'll just read it for us here. So Galatians 2, 11 to 14. But when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face, this is Paul speaking, because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile, not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Let me just pray for us as we move forward. Lord, I ask that you would let this time be according to your purposes and desires, and that you would let your word, the grace and the truth of Jesus, come forth in your word. Would you fill us with your spirit and give us eyes to see and ears to hear? In Jesus' name, amen. What we have here, actually, when it says Cephas, that means Peter, the Apostle Peter. It's another name, one of Peter's other names. Sometimes that gets confusing. So what's happening here? You've got Peter is in Antioch. Antioch's a city in the ancient world where there's both Jews and a lot of Gentiles that have come to have faith in Jesus. And Peter was initially eating with the Gentiles. Everybody, Jews and Gentiles, everybody in the church was eating together, which to us is like, well, duh, isn't that what you're supposed to do? But the problem is, in the Old Testament, there were these clean laws, these laws that tried to help us understand how holy God is and how we can't just stroll into his presence. And so there were these clean laws. And in the first century, the Pharisees, they added to the clean laws, and they said a Jew can't eat with a Gentile because you'll be polluted if you do that, because Gentiles are unclean, and we're Jews, we want to be clean. And so you can't eat with the Gentiles. And so those first century Jews, not for the most part, they didn't eat. They wouldn't associate with Gentiles. But when Peter became a Christian, and then even as he was growing in what understanding what his faith meant, he had this dream. And it was God gave him this dream of this big sheet coming down with full of unclean animals, things that the Old Testament said don't eat, and this voice saying, kill and eat these. It was part of this thing of how God showed Peter that in Jesus' life and death for us, that he abolished the clean laws, that he fulfilled the clean laws. And so in Jesus, all foods are clean, all people are clean. And so Peter, realizing what Jesus had done for him in that sense, was eating with the Gentiles. He's like, Jesus made everyone clean. Jesus wants his community to be interacting together because Jesus is our cleanliness, not who we eat with or don't eat with. But the problem is then, verse 12, for before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. So there's some people that come from the Apostle James in Jerusalem. Now, whether James said, okay, you guys go up there and do this, or whether they kind of got the wrong idea, or whether they're like, well, we're with James, we don't know exactly. But they come up and they tell Peter, You have to not eat with the Gentiles. You've got to separate from them. And it's probably because of this circumcision party. What that probably means is it's Jewish believer, Jewish people who are very strong in their belief, and they're sort of asserting, no, you know, Jews can't eat with Gentiles, right? So there's this kind of argument between hardcore Jews and Christians in terms of, can you eat with Gentiles or not? And so this is Peter's big decision, right? This is one of those not quite clear-cut things. So Peter's got some people telling him, no, you can't eat with the Gentiles. And he's got other things thinking, but I had this dream, I think it's okay. This was his big decision, and he made the wrong decision. He separated from the Gentiles, and he drew back away from them to maintain this cleanliness, these clean laws. So, and that's his bad decision. That's his hypocrisy. And the reason it's hypocrisy is what Paul says in verse 14. If you, a Jew, Peter's a Jew, right? But Peter doesn't live like a Jew. Peter doesn't keep every single Old Testament law. He doesn't believe that my relationship with God is based on how well I keep the laws. He believes his relationship with God is based on what Jesus has done for him in his death and life and resurrection for him. So Peter's a Jew, but Peter doesn't live like a Jew. But what Peter's doing is he's forcing the Gentiles to live like Jews. So he's saying, I'm a Jew, but I'm not going to live like a Jew, but you Gentiles, you should be following these Old Testament laws. Even though I'm not following them, you should be following them. That's part of what is coming out of this decision. And so Paul calls him a hypocrite. Hypocrite literally means someone who judges from underneath. But what it took on was it meant an actor in a Greek theater play. Right, so you've got these Greek actors, and they were called hypocrites, right? Because they were pretending to be someone they're not. So that's where the word comes from. So Paul's saying, you're pretending to be someone that you're not. You're asking other people to do things that you don't do yourself. How do we become hypocrites? One way, I think, is because we're strict with laws for other people, but we're lax with the same laws for ourselves. Right? It can be God's laws, or it can be our own sense of, oh, this is the right way to do something. We generally enforce laws strictly on other people, but for me, it's complicated. It's a different situation. We find ways out for ourselves. I think that hypocrisy is something that all humans actually struggle with, because by nature we're opinionated. By nature we think this is right and this is wrong. We have convictions about different things, but by nature we're also frail and we can't even live up to our own standards. And so, so on the front of your bulletin, the second quote is where Jesus says. Talks about money and hypocrisy. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogue and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. So he's saying that there's people that are acting like they're sincerely trying to give an offering to God, but they're doing something else, pretending in a different way in order to get praise to themselves. And then even one of the New York Times things that was interesting was about Thomas Jefferson, the top quote. There's something unbelievable about Thomas Jefferson, the icon. He's either a national hero or a national disgrace, a champion of American liberty, or in all imaginable forms, or a hypocrite who refused to free his slaves. And so I think as human beings, we struggle with hypocrisy, but here's the Apostle Peter, the leader of the Christian church at this time, being accused of hypocrisy in his very self. It was funny when I, just after I had married Kathy, I was at her home, and her brother-in-law's family lived with them. And one time I was sitting down eating with her brother-in-law, and we sat down to eat, and he said, "I caught you. You didn't pray." Right? His view was that Christians have this law that they have to fulfill, like that you have to bow your head in a show, give thanks to God before you eat. Right? So he had this opinion, this view that's what Christianity meant. And he thought he had caught me. He thought he had been able to assign a hypocrite to me. And so I tried to explain, well, it's not the law. It's gratitude in your heart. And you can do it internally. You can do it silently. You can do it publicly with a bowed head. But why does the church get so much flack why does it get accused of being hypocrites so often? Sometimes that occurs just because they don't understand that Christianity is not a morality play, or it's not a set of rules that if you follow them, you get rewarded at the end. But sometimes also Christians do a really good job of being very critical about moral issues for other people and yet violating them ourselves. And so in a lot of ways, we end up asking for that, even though, and in that we're not showing them what gospel Christianity really is like, but we're showing them our own frailty. But I think one of the most important things just out of this hypocrisy showing up in this text is that the Bible's own revelation of God's word to us includes the fact that we're going to mess up. Right? It's built into what God wants to reveal to humanity right here, this instant of not just any Christian, but the leader of the whole Christian movement messes up. And so I don't think there's any other philosophy or moral structure or spiritual system that accounts for and includes our failure in the midst of how it's describing people following God or describing how we come to know God. And so the Bible is unique in the fact that it even brings this out. It's also an aspect of what's one reason we can believe this account is, like, if Paul and Peter or anybody was making this up, they wouldn't put this in here. Right? It's embarrassing that this occurs, but it's what really occurred. So why do we become hypocrites? So if you look at the last quote in the first of the bulletin, Jesus says one of the reasons is because of pride. If you look at this last quote, then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle Jesus in his words, and they sent their disciples to him along with Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you're true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you're not swayed by appearances. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why do you put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." So one way that we become hypocrites is that we're very prideful and we think we're above being truthful and sincere, and we're trying to trap people, right? The Pharisees are trying to trap Jesus, but they're showing hypocrisy in the midst of that. But why does Peter specifically commit hypocrisy? It's in verse 12. "But fearing the circumcision party." So Peter was afraid of this group of people that were kind of enemies of the faith, but he was afraid of them. He also might have been he was unduly swayed by the people that came from James. But so fear led Peter into this hypocrisy. But the weird thing with fear and pride is that fear and pride can lead us to do the wrong things, but it's also what we use to lead us to do the right things. I remember when I was living with Kathy, we were living with Kathy's family, and I was working at their company, and one of the family members I would go in the morning, very early in the mornings with them to work, and I do not love getting up early in the morning at all, but I was very diligent in getting up every single morning I was supposed to and ready on time. And it was because of fear. It's because of, I knew that if I let this person down, that I would, either directly or indirectly, probably both, get it big time. And so fear made me do the right thing, right? And pride oftentimes makes us do the right thing. We think, oh, I don't want to be considered that kind of person, and so I'm not going to do this thing that would reflect badly on people or badly on me. I'm going to do this better, right thing. But the funny thing with fear and pride is that it both leads us to do the wrong things, but also leads us to do morally good things. Many of us are studying using this book, Gospel and Life, to as a discipleship tool for the men's study Tuesday mornings, and the women's study Thursday mornings. Let me read to you what Tim Keller says about fear and pride. Think of all the ways you can say no to ungodliness. You can say no because I'll look bad. You can say no, I'll be excluded from social circles I want to belong to. You can say no because then God will not bless me. You can say no to ungodliness because I'll hate myself in the morning and have low self-esteem. Virtually all these motives, however, are really just motives of fear and pride, the very things that also lead us to sin. You are just using the same self-centered impulses of the heart to keep you compliant to external rules without really changing the heart itself. Also, you're not really doing anything out of love for God. You're using God to get things, self-esteem, prosperity, social approval. So your deepest joys and hopes rest in those things, not God. So part of why Peter fell into this hypocrisy was his fear of these people. Peter didn't have the courage to stand up for what was right. What is it that you're afraid of? What are the areas in which fear could, what are the areas in which you use fear to do the right thing? And what are the areas where, what are the things you fear that could lead you to do the wrong thing? Or put another way, who are the people from James in your life? Who are the people that are on your side but have a different opinion and they sway you to do something that you're maybe not quite, that it's not the right thing for you to do? Or who are the people of the circumcision for you, the people that are opposed to you and fear of them leads you to not choose to do the right thing? You know, it's interesting, many of you would know, right, one of the most famous quotes in the Bible is, fear of the Lord leads to wisdom, right? Wisdom, the wisdom of the Lord begins with the fear of the Lord. One of the most commonly known that everybody should know. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Gosh. So your fear of not saying the right thing. So what's the difference between these fears? Peter fears the circumcision party and does wrong, but we're supposed to fear God. There's a great verse in Exodus 20:20 that says, "Do not fear, but fear the Lord so that you may know him." It's great. One verse is, "Do not fear, but fear." And it's the same root word there. What's getting at is, with God, we're not supposed to fear punishment. The difference between fearing God and fearing the circumcision party or fearing what other people are going to think of you is that when we think of fear negatively, we think of, I'm going to get punished by that fear, or something bad's going to happen to me, so I better do it so I avoid avoid that bad thing. Fear of God is both realizing God's value and not wanting to oppose that or work against that value, also realizing his preciousness and not wanting to, like having a precious, valuable vase, and the way that you handle that vase is with a certain amount of fear because you don't want to do anything to harm it. But there's also a fear of respect and awe, that God is not like humans, and God is other, and he's completely holy and righteous and perfect, and when we come before God, we're coming before the one who's created us and created everything and who holds our soul and our life and everything in his hands. And so, but we're never supposed to fear punishment from God. We're supposed to fear how we might hurt our relationship with him, or how we might not respond to him with the honor that he deserves. So what are you afraid of? Or what's the area of fear in your life that's where you have the most potential to be led astray in a different way? This same book talks about one way to do that is to boil down all the reasons why we might fear down to because we seek approval, because we seek power. Right? We fear that we'll lose people's approval, which might well be what's going on for Peter here. And for others of us, it might be that we fear we're going to lose control of our lives, or we're going to lose control of how our lives and situations are going. Others of us fear loss of power. Some of us fear loss of comfort. Right? People in the circumcision could have made life very uncomfortable for Peter. So what is it you fear? What are the things that could lead you to do things that you don't desire? Reflecting just back on this week, I can see how fear and pride led me to do things I had to fix later, or that I had to, or that I didn't do the right way. That I was a fear of losing someone's approval, and so I started down a road that out of doing that, and then realized, gosh, you know, this is not the right way. I had to turn around and come back. And so, whether you get accused of being a hypocrite, or whether you realize afterwards yourself, gosh, I didn't do that right. One important thing is to figure out what was going on in that situation. What was I fearing? Or what was I so proud about that led me to act in that way? So what are we supposed to do? What do we do about hypocrisy? Paul shows us some great things here. Right? Paul doesn't just come up and say to Peter, you broke the not eating with Gentiles rule. Right? There's no law about that. But so Paul doesn't come up and say, you broke a certain law. He doesn't come up and say, Peter, Jesus puts you in charge of all this thing and look what you've done. And he doesn't use guilt on him. He doesn't say, how could you? You spent 4 years intimately with Jesus. If I had that, I would be far beyond where you are. So he doesn't use guilt. He doesn't manipulate him. What does he say? He says, but when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, not in step with the truth of the gospel. So that means the gospel's more than just this on-ramp to relationship with God. It means the gospel itself has direction built into it, right? The gospel is like, it's like a laser pointer that points a line, walk in this way, go in this way. It's actually, in one sense, I mean, the law of the Old Testament is still important for Christians because it shows us God's intention for humanity. But in one sense, Paul's perhaps saying the gospel has its own ethical, legal, directional qualities built right into it. Right? So the gospel's not just how we enter life with God, and then it's also not just how we are pointed where to walk. The gospel actually addresses our fears. Right? So Peter should have been reflecting on the gospel points the way to walk. One thing Paul's saying is here, the unity of everybody believing in Jesus, eating together, is so much more valuable and important than what you did, than your drawing back. And Peter might have drawn back for good reasons. He might have thought, oh yeah, if we keep pressing this Jew-Gentile barrier, then we're going to undermine our witness to Jews about the gospel of Jesus. The people in James might have put this pressure on him and said, you know, you're going to mess up the whole, you're going to tear apart the whole Jerusalem movement if you do this. So Peter might have had good reasons that were reasonably good, or at least okay. But Paul's saying, no, you missed the bigger reason, that the ethics of the gospel is that Jesus has bridged Jew and Greek. Jesus has bridged men and women and slave and free, as we're going to see later in Galatians. He's made one family that we all can draw together around. And so by pulling away from the Gentiles, you've broken that huge value, that huge ethic of the gospel. I think Paul would say also, Peter, you need to reflect more on where the gospel is pointing, because the gospel does heal our fears. Right? Jesus says, do not fear those that can destroy the body, but fear the him who can send body and soul to Hades. Right? So fearing God over humans, right? It's possible that the Jews could have made life uncomfortable for Peter. They could have even persecuted him, attacked him. But the gospel tells us that's a very small thing in perspective to violating this eating together that Jesus has created for us. So the gospel is the on-ramp to relationship with God. The gospel directs us in how we are supposed to live and walk. It helps heal our pride, our fear and our pride. But then the gospel also forgives us when we fail, right? Peter failed here, but Peter's not cast out. We don't know exactly what happened here, but after this, and scholars would be dying to find a text from Barnabas or Peter that tells what happened, but we don't know exactly what happened. But built also into the gospel is forgiveness when we mess it up, when we get the decision wrong. It's part of what we have in the gospel. And so Paul is calling Peter and calling us to this harder work of thinking, when we have a decision to make, how do we use the gospel to help make that decision? So in one sense, the opposite of being a hypocrite is making the right decision. And so that's why I asked us, think about what goes into our decisions. Is it Peter? Because Peter was probably thinking rationally. He might have had a gut reaction to this. He's like common sense. But no, Paul is saying you needed to reflect on the direction the gospel leads in order to make that decision as well. Which is not easy, right? It's easier to have a law that says, don't do this. Okay, I won't do that. Or I'll do it and then I'll just have to get forgiven later. But the reflecting on the gospel and the values and the textures and the ethics and the direction that gospel wants my life to point is hard. But that's what Paul was calling Peter to do. And I think that's what this passage would call us to do, is to realize in the gospel we have this great resource that does help us with our hardest questions, with the hardest questions of where to go, what to do, how to relate to people. So just because the Bible doesn't have a command or an imperative about something doesn't mean, okay, well, I get to make this decision my own. Now we pick up the gospel, the multifaceted gospel, and say, how does this suggest that I walk? In what direction do I need to walk? And so even so, this question on Sunday school, do we need to have Sunday school because that's what churches are supposed to do? No, who cares about breaking the Sunday school law, right? That's not why we would want to do this. Do we need to have Sunday school because, gosh, there's some people who only come to a church that has Sunday school? That would be acting out of fear of, gosh, we won't be able to draw the people in unless we have Sunday school. But now the gospel would say, have times where we're teaching and training each other in the truth of God. Did you notice in the New York Times the Pew test on religion? I wanted to print it out so we all could take it. I mean, maybe we'll do it next week. But the Pew Charitable Trust had 3,000 people take a 32-question test on religion, so who got the highest score? Atheists. Right, these are questions about the Old Testament, New Testament, about Islam and Hinduism. I mean, some of these things are like, what's the first book in the Bible? Or who led the Israelites out of Egypt. Atheists got the highest score. And then agnostics. And then Jews. And then Mormons. And then Protestant Christians. That's one reason why we need to have Sunday school. And it felt good because when I was back at CGS, I did a thing on world religions, and people got really sick and tired of it. But if they were listening, they would have known who Vishnu and Shiva was, and they would have gotten that question right. So the gospel would say we need to know God's truth, but we need to know it in community. We need to know it in a place where we can ask questions and be back and forth and have all of us contribute to that. And so this type of Sunday school we're envisioning is going to allow that. It's going to allow for lots of discussion, back and forth, presentation of material, but application questions. It's going to allow for prayer. It's going to allow for, how's everybody doing? Here's some topics we need to talk about Grace Hill right now. Let's work through this. So the gospel would say be a community. This hour that we're envisioning would help us to even be more of a community. So the main point, the gospel helps us with our potential to be hypocrites because it provides the means to come to know God through Christ, but then also the values and ethics, that line to walk as well in terms of the challenges of everyday life. And yet then it also provides the means for our forgiveness when we fail to live up to that because sin has not been taken away from us. Because it's slowly being eradicated, because we're growing in rightness, but we fail. We're weak, and we need the gospel every day. I think this is one of those texts that we got to hang on to and reflect more and more and think about, how do I walk in line with the gospel?